44 and 45. When Maharaj Vasudeva was about to be initiated for the sacrifice, O king, the Vrishnis came to the initiation pavilion after bathing and putting on fine clothes and garlands of lotuses. Their other kings also came, elaborately ornamented, as well as all their joyful queens who wore jeweled lockets around their necks and were also clad in fine garments. The royal wives were anointed with sandalwood paste and carried auspicious items for the worship. Mridangas, patahas, conch shells, berries, anakas, and other instruments resounded. Male and female dancers danced, and suttas and magadhas recited glorification. Sweet-voiced Gandharvas sang, accompanied by their husbands. 47. After Vasudeva's eyes had been decorated with black cosmetic and his body smeared with fresh butter, the priest initiated him according to the scriptural rules by sprinkling him with his 18 wives with sacred waters. Encircled by his wives, he resembled the regal moon encircled by stars. Purport. Devaki was Vasudeva's principal wife, but she had several co-wives, including her six sisters. This fact is recorded in the ninth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Devakas kangrisheshnascha katvaro devakatmaja deva van ubadevascha sudevo davavardana tesham svasara saptasan dritta deva dayo nripa shanti devo padevacha shri deva devakshakshita sahadeva devakicha vasudeva uvahata. Translation. Ahuka had two sons named Devaka and Ugrasena. Devaka had four sons named Devavan, Upadeva, Sudeva, and Devartana, and he also had seven daughters named Shanti Deva, Upadeva, Srideva, Devarkashita, Sahadeva, Devaki, and Dhritadeva. Dhritadeva was the eldest. Vasudev, the father of Krishna, married all of these sisters. Some of Vasudeva's other wives are mentioned a few verses later. Paurvi Rohini Bhadra Madhira Rochana Ila Devaki Pramukaschayasan Patna Anakadun Dube. Devaki, Paurvi, Rohini, Bhadra, Madhira, Rochana, Ila, and others were all wives of Anakadun Dube, Vasudev. Among them all, Devaki was the chief. And continuing, 48. Vasudeva received initiation along with his wives, who wore silk saris and were adorned with bangles, necklaces, ankle bells, and earrings. With his body wrapped in a deer skin, Vasudeva shone splendidly. My dear Maharaj Parikit, Vasudeva's priests and officiating members of the assembly, dressed in silk dhotis and jeweled ornaments, looked so effulgent that they seemed to be standing in the sacrificial arena of Indra, the killer of Vritta. At that time, Balaram and Krishna, the lords of all living entities, shone forth with great majesty in the company of their respective sons, wives, and other family members, who were expansions of their opulences. And text 51. Performing various kinds of Vedic sacrifice according to proper regulation, Vasudeva worshiped the Lord of all sacrificial paraphernalia, mantras, and rituals. He executed both primary and secondary sacrifices, offering oblations to the sacred fire and carrying out other aspects of sacrificial worship. So in this purport, we're going to hear some of the specific technical information about sacrifices. There are numerous kinds of Vedic fire sacrifice, each of which involves several elaborate rituals. The Brahman portion of the Vedic Shruti specifies the complete step-by-step procedure of only a few prototype sacrifices, such as Jyotishtoma and Darshapurnamasa. These are called the Prakrita, or original jagyas. The details of other jagyas must be extrapolated from the patterns of these Prakrita injunctions and according to the strict rules of Mimamsa Shastra. Since other jagyas are thus known by derivation from the prototype sacrifices, they are called Vikrita, or changed. Everybody got that? Good. Okay. Om Jnana Timurandisha Gnanjana Salakaya Chakshurulmikamena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Panchako Patrubhischa Kripa Sindhu Bebacha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. Hare Krishna Jaya Prabhupada. So we're getting a lot of information about sacrifice. In the preceding verses, we talked about that to some degree. What is the purpose of the Vedic sacrifices? Looking at both the karmakanda idea of materialistic sacrifices for specific rewards, worship of the different demigods. And now we're hearing a little bit more about these specific sacrifices which are intended to be offered to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, just to make sure everybody's awake, how many wives did Vasudeva have? Total. 18. All right. And how many of those were all sisters? And who was the chief wife amongst them? Devaki. Okay. All right. Everyone's awake. You're listening. Good. So, in terms of sacrifice, we can understand that of all the different sacrifices that are given in the Vedas, we are mostly concerned about those which are directed towards Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And while there may be many different technical aspects of these, as I think Krishna Kesha was pointing out in yesterday's class, so many of these are not so much suitable in Kali Yuga. We don't really have the abilities. We don't have the trained Brahmins. We don't have the vast amounts of gold and everything else that was needed for these. So therefore, we look at the more simple sacrifice of Sankirtan Jagya offered to Krishna. But sacrifice is an important concept, and I think we should talk about that a little bit. What does it actually mean? What is this idea of sacrifice or Jagya, austerity? How does this actually apply to us in our sort of modern 21st century Krishna consciousness? Of course, we can go back about 5,000 years and longer in oral tradition to the Bhagavad Gita to really understand the essence of what sacrifice means. If we look at the Bhagavad Gita 3.10, we have this very nice verse. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures, Krishna, sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu and blessed them by saying, be thou happy by this jagya sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. So this is sort of the big picture of why Krishna is saying that one should perform sacrifice. And Prabhupada explains this really very nicely in a couple lines in the purport. Srila Prabhupada says, the Lord created this material world to enable the conditioned souls to learn how to perform jagya sacrifice for the satisfaction of Vishnu, so that while in the material world, they can live very comfortably without anxiety, and after finishing the present material body, they can enter into the kingdom of God. And now a very nice line by Srila Prabhupada. He says, that is the whole program for the conditioned soul. So that's it. That's what we need to know. Worship Krishna in this lifetime, and then get out. Go back to Godhead. That's our program. So we step back just a second, and based upon what we've heard in this verse and purport, and just generally what you know about Krishna consciousness and understanding the philosophy, my question is, and we'll address it to the students first, maybe the older students, why did Krishna create the material world? What is the purpose? Oh, we have a couple of hands already. Go ahead. Okay, Krishna is the supreme enjoyer, and he made a world so we can enjoy. Why was that again? I missed the part in there. Why did he? What was the first thing you said? Exactly. So did everyone hear that? He was saying because we wanted to be the controller, and Krishna already has his own spiritual world where who's the controller there? Krishna. So guess what? If you want to be the controller, you need a separate place, right? You can't be the controller in the spiritual world. And that's one of the reasons why Krishna created the material world. That's a really very, very good answer. Other thoughts on it? Yes, Bethany. We didn't want to serve Krishna, you're saying? So we felt we wanted to come to the material world? Because we didn't want to be with Krishna. We didn't want to be with Krishna. We didn't want to serve. Therefore, Krishna had to create this place. Those are all really good answers. One more? Jealous? Yes. There's another word we often use. Envious? Same thing. Yeah. jealous or envious of Krishna, and we wanted that position. Now, was there any, so in other words, these are all getting kind of to the point that it's like a, almost like a punishment, right? In other words, we were envious of Krishna, we wanted to be the enjoyer, we wanted to be the controller, therefore, there you go, out of the spiritual world here. But is there any positive purpose of the material world? Is there anything good about it in terms of the living entity? Go ahead. It's what? Then you can serve Krishna here, even in the material world, right? That's certainly that's a part of it. One more in the back. In order to test us. Well, that's actually a very profound point, because it really is, because that's a little goes a little deeper, because Maya does test us in this material world to see if whether we're really sincere and whether we really want to go back to Godhead with Krishna, or do we still want to stay here and enjoy. Yes, the material world is also a test. I didn't thought about that. That was really good. But what in general, and someone started to say it before, what in general does the material world allow us to do? Go ahead. One of the young ladies. It allows us to enjoy. That's right. And what else? Is there another choice? What? To serve Krishna. Yes. So the material world really has two purposes. One, it's a place for the rebellious souls we're talking about to live separately from Krishna. But it's also a place of reformation. Have you ever heard of, sometimes they call a prison a reformatory, or sometimes like a juvenile detention, they call them reformatory schools? Okay, it's kind of, I don't know if that term's still used or not, but they used to call, but reformatory means a place where it's like a punishment, like you have to go into prison, but at the same time, reformatory means it's a place to reform or change or get better. Now, of course, modern prisons don't usually do that. Usually they learn better techniques and how to be criminals from the other criminals. But nevertheless, the concept was there. You know, in other words, that, you know, that one should reform. So this material world is also like that. It's a reformatory. It's a chance for the conditioned souls to give up those envious material desires, live peacefully in this world, and then serve Krishna nicely, get out, go back to Godhead. So in other words, Krishna didn't just say, all right, you're envious. You know, I've got this material world, which is full of suffering and everything. There you go. You're stuck. No, because Krishna loves us very much. Krishna loves every living entity, every one of us, as his part and parcel. We are part of Krishna. You know, it's just like if you're, well, the children don't relate to this, but the parents can. If you have a child that goes off and is doing bad things and is getting in trouble, and, you know, this happens with kids sometimes. They're all really, really nice, wonderful devotees. But sometimes, some kids get older, they go a little astray. It happens. It does. And so is the parent might think, okay, I don't want anything to do with them. They've gone bad. They've disobeyed what I want them to do. But if that child, it's actually a biblical story called The Prodigal Son, right, which is about this. But if that child then comes back and says, all right, I really want to come back. I want to be part of the family. I want to be a devotee again and all this. Then what does the parent do? Does the parent say, forget it, you left? Do they? No. What would they say? Welcome back. Yes, exactly. Welcome back. So Krishna's saying, welcome back to us. We may have left and made a bad choice. You know how they say sometimes we make bad choices? You ever discuss that with your teachers about making good choices and bad choices? Well, way back in the early dawn of history, way back millions and millions of years and lifetimes ago, we made a bad choice. We made a bad choice leaving Krishna, coming to this material world. So now Krishna is saying, make a better choice. Make a good choice. And Krishna gives us opportunities. He comes himself. He gives his scriptures, like Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. And he sends his great devotees, his pure devotees like Srila Prabhupada, to help bring us back. So we have this opportunity to live happily within this material world. And that's where our original idea of Jagya that we're talking about comes in. Because to live happily in this world and to become purified and rectified and be able to go back to Godhead means we need to change a little bit. We need to have a better understanding of our relationship with Krishna and begin the process of devotional service of bhakti, which will bring us back to him. So when we say this word sacrifice, what is that? Does everyone think that's a great thing? Everybody says, yay, sacrifice. Jagya, austerity. Not really, does it? I mean, not people don't really like this term sacrifice so much because our emphasis in the material world is not sacrifice. It's something very different. And we call it sense gratification. It's kind of like the opposite of sacrifice is materialism or sense gratification. And that's where most of us are stuck in this world. We're very enamored by personal gratification. And in fact, even in terms of history and culture, many even non-devotee commentators have noted that our generations are getting more and more increasingly self-absorbed. They call it the me generation or these different terms that they use out there because even like older people have noted that successive generations seem to become more and more absorbed towards personal sense gratification. Now, if you ever study sociology, they have, or anthropology, there's terms that they talk about different cultures. And one way that they classify cultures is there's a difference between what we call collectivist cultures and individualistic cultures. I think, where am I going with that? Okay. Well, in a collectivist culture, the people generally work for collective or shared goals. So there's a big emphasis on the family, on the village, on the community, perhaps even on the nation. In other words, I may have to actually, this word, sacrifice somewhat for the betterment of the whole, for the good of everyone, right? You can understand that. And we have some cultures are more individualistic, where the emphasis is on personal gratification, personal satisfaction, what do I do, how will I be happy in life, and how do I get ahead, and not so much concern with everyone else. What would be a typical individualistic culture society? Can you think of one that has that emphasis? You might be living in such a society at this very moment. Okay, America is like the epitome of an individualistic culture. And a collectivist culture might be more like what? What? Any thoughts? Maybe the adults? Okay. Well, Soviet Union? Yeah, that's sort of an extreme. Latin American countries, actually Asian countries are often like that. India's more so, I think, at least it used to be, until American culture came and ruined everything. But often your Asian cultures, Japan, China, very much like this. In other words, a lot of emphasis on beyond oneself towards the greater good. Now, if you take that a little further, obviously the greater good of everyone is Krishna consciousness. In other words, to give up, to go beyond myself and my own thinking, and even beyond my family, my village, my country, is to think of all of humanity, thinking of the universal good of everyone. Like we have the example of Vasudeva Dutta and Chaitanya Charitamrita. What did Vasudeva Dutta want to do? Anybody remember? It was an incarnation of Prahlad Maharaj, or not an incarnation. I guess you could say an incarnation. He wanted to take everybody's sins, that he would take them upon himself so they could go back to Godhead and he'd be willing to stay and suffer the material world. That's kind of like the polar opposite of individualism. That's one of our greatest devotees. In other words, thinking beyond oneself, not just for what I want today, but what is for the best for everyone and ultimately the spiritual benefit of the world. Now, if we look at this idea of sacrifice, it's not as though, well, if I weren't a devotee, I wouldn't have to sacrifice. You think that's true? You think the non-devotee materialists, they don't sacrifice anything? Sacrifice all the time. Everyone has to sacrifice to get something of value. If I want to be a medical doctor, who's here? Prabhu. How many years of school did you have to go to become a doctor? Total, from undergraduate all the way through residency and... How many? 20 years. 20 years to reach his position. He has a nice position, nice service being a doctor. 20 years of study it took him to get that. So in other words, anything of value, great example, thank you. I'm glad I saw you there. Anything of value takes sacrifice, even in the material world. I was in Hawaii recently, I was not on vacation on the GBC there. I was so I was visiting, and one young couple, very nice couple, second generation couple. They're professional. One's a doctor, one's a lawyer. You think they have plenty of money? In Hawaii, it's so expensive, land and property, that they had to like save and save and save for years just to make a down payment to buy their own house for their family. So things of value require sacrifice. That's the point. So here's my question. What have you, in your own life, what have you had to sacrifice? Not just sacrifice like, oh, I had to do this, they made me do it, but sacrifice something you wanted to give up so that you could get something else. What have you sacrificed for a higher purpose, for something better? It doesn't have to be, you know, like, so you could go back to Godhead. I mean, you know, just in your regular life. What are some things you have to sacrifice? Yeah. Sacrifice your money to get your toy. Well, yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay, now we're getting down to the, you know, where it's, come on. How about the young ladies over here, our older girls? You all have experienced something. Okay, what would you like to do in an ideal world? Goof off and play all day, right? Okay, do you ever not do that for something else? Homework? Who said that? Go ahead. See, great example. So you babysit, you work to make some money to get something else that you want. Right. She doesn't particularly want to do the work, but she's willing to do it to get something else. Yeah. Oh, you're saving money? You're... Okay. In other words, you're going to India, but you actually have to sacrifice leaving your school and your friends and everything else. Yeah. Yeah, because that's something very valuable. The opportunity to go to India, see the holy places, right? Be in the Dham. Something of great value. So you have to sacrifice something else to get it. Great examples. Any others? Does anyone take lessons in anything? Does anyone practice? Yes, some of you. Do some of you practice in sports? Do you practice musical instruments? Right? Does that take some time? Sometimes it's a sacrifice. You think, oh, I don't know if I want to go. But you do it because you're gaining something higher. Right? Okay, so understand this idea of sacrifice. It's necessary. It's required. And, you know, Prabhupada even gave the example. You know, he said, young children don't really want to be in school. Prabhupada knew this. He said, they want to play. They don't want to be in school. He says, but it's a sacrifice for them. To be able to learn, to be able to do things, to have a job, to be able to do the things you want to do as an adult, you sacrifice to go to school. Okay. So the highest principle of sacrifice, you knew we'd get to this sooner or later, is a sacrifice in devotional service. Sacrifice to Krishna, as we were reading this verse 3:10. It says, sacrifice for Krishna or Vishnu is recommended. So, whatever we have to give up or do, it should be done ultimately for Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita 9:27, we hear yat karoshi, yat ashnasi, yat jahosi, didasi yat, yat tapasyasi kuntaya, tad kurushva madharpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, those sacrifices, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. So Krishna is saying, ultimately, all of those sacrifices, whatever you do, whatever you're offering, do them for me. Do them as an offering for me. And what is the result of that offering to Krishna? We become happy. Krishna says, 5:29, the famous peace formula verse, a person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerity, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. So the result of not sacrificing for Krishna, the result of simply trying to enjoy one's own life, enjoying materialism, personal sense gratification, actually is not happiness. In illusion, in this material world, we think it will bring us happiness. We think, okay, well, we don't even think that we've loved Krishna. We don't even know we've loved Krishna. But we think this pursuit of sense gratification will bring happiness. But it doesn't. The reality is suffering will come. Prabhupada says nobody wants suffering, yet it comes. Even happiness comes by its own accord. What to speak of suffering? So our experience of happiness that we have in this material world is often very flickering. It's also often very temporary. And sometimes it's not even real happiness. Sometimes it's what we call the cessation of pain. You know what the cessation of pain is? Think of the last time you were sick and you felt really awful, felt miserable. And then one day you wake up and you feel a lot better. You know, the illness is gone, the fever's down, right? And you feel really good. Sometimes you feel really good. You think you're happy and you feel good. What you're really feeling is that you're no longer feeling sick. It's the absence of pain. Or you really hurt yourself, but then the pain goes away. And saying, oh, I feel so good now. It doesn't really feel good particularly. It just no longer is in pain. Okay? And I'll leave that this idea with one I mentioned this one before. It's one of my favorite quotes from a great personality named Albert Schweitzer, which nobody under age 70 has ever heard of. But he actually was a famous doctor. He was a missionary in Africa. He won a Nobel Peace Prize, and he was actually a vegetarian. So this is back in the 30s and 40s or whenever he lived. So another was a very pious person. And Albert Schweitzer said, happiness is nothing more than good health and a bad memory. Get it? Okay. Because we're feeling good now, and we forget all the bad times that we had. So that was had a little bit of wisdom. So anyway, in the material world, science, medicine, education, business, you name it, every possible endeavor is trying to alleviate suffering in the material world. When you come right down to it, that's what they're all trying to do, alleviate suffering. But sometimes the result is actually an increase in suffering. And there's a famous little phrase that Prahlad Maharaj said, two words. Can we think of it? What he called this illusory happiness? Maya Sukhaya. Maya Sukhaya Bharam Udvahota Vimudhan. Vimudhan, fools. Fools and rascals are making elaborate plans for material happiness and suffering, for material happiness and maintaining families, societies, and countries. And Prabhupada said in the purport, oh no, actually this was in a lecture on that verse, he says, actually this is a fact. We have a humbug civilization. Prabhupada used these interesting words. So many cars are being manufactured every year, and for that purpose, so many roads have to be excavated and prepared. This creates problem after problem. Therefore, it is Maya Sukhaya, illusory happiness, and yet we are trying to be happy in this way. So, first of all, the attempt is futile. We really can't control material nature. You know, there's always hurricanes or this or that, and we can't stop them. We think we study economics, but yet it's recessions, inflation, everything goes on. Medicine can't prevent death. And sometimes, as Prabhupada was saying, that our attempts at increasing happiness actually do the opposite, like cars cause pollution, energy spills, they fight over the oil, have wars, things like that. And finally, we're ignoring the real problems of life, birth, death, disease, and old age, that none of these things can fix. Thank you all for your attention. Sorry, I kept you a little long here. So, if we're going to perform yajna to try to alleviate the suffering of material life and try to reconnect with Krishna, we want to do the right yajna, the right sacrifice. And in this age, the Sankirtan yajna, the chanting of the holy name, is recommended. In Lord Chaitanya Shikshastakam, the Chaita Dharpana Marjanam, let there all be all victory for the chanting of the holy name of Lord Krishna, which cleanses the mirror of the heart and stops the misery of the blazing fire of material existence. Now, in the Science of Self-Realization, Prabhupada talks about this Chaita Dharpana Marjanam verse of Lord Chaitanya's. And this is a really, really nice purport. Prabhupada says, Marjanam means cleanse, and Dharpana means mirror. The heart is a mirror. It's like a camera. Just as a camera takes all kinds of pictures of days and nights, So also our heart takes pictures and keeps them in an unconscious state. Psychologists know this. The heart takes so many pictures and therefore it becomes covered. We do not know when it has begun, but it is a fact that because there's material contact, our real identity is covered. Therefore, Cheto Dharpana Marjanam, one has to cleanse his heart. So Prabhupada is talking about these pictures, these impressions that are there on the heart. He said it's just like a camera. The mind is constantly having all of these impressions, and they are kept. They are stored. It's like you have a camera and you store it on some disk or, you know, some little internal memory device that's there. But they become covered. And we don't really know the real self because of these coverings. And Prabhupada said it's like the mirror. The heart is a mirror. And it's covered by this dust of all of these different impressions, so we don't see our real self. So understanding real knowledge and real seeing is seeing the self and seeing ourselves in relationship with Krishna. Prabhupada gave the example, just like it's dark, and then the sun begins to rise. And as it becomes, we can't see anything, we can't see ourselves, we can't see the sun. And as the sun rises, we begin to see everything around us, we begin to see ourselves, and then finally we actually see the sun. So in the same way, when the dust of the mirror of the mind begins to be cleansed by the process of bhakti yoga, of hearing and chanting the names of Krishna, that cleansing process means we begin to see ourselves, who we really are as spirit soul. We begin to see around us. We understand material nature. We understand the nature of other jivas. And finally, as the sun finally rises, we begin to understand Krishna and our relationship with Krishna. So these deep mental impressions are interesting. And Prabhupada mentioned psychology here because, of course, psychology is concerned with understanding how experiences and impressions from earlier years, especially childhood, may have caused the formation of the way that we see the world now. And that was kind of the basis. That was the big breakthrough that Sigmund Freud made. Of course, no one really follows Freud very much now, but he made some very important contributions. One was that understanding that past experience forms our current consciousness. Now, what Freud and the psychologists didn't realize, it's not just these impressions from this lifetime, but also from past lifetimes. They all help to create these impressions. These impressions are called sanskaras, right? So where some sanskara is there. Sanskara we often think about as purificatory rituals, but it also sometimes means these impressions. And, you know, I was looking, and I couldn't find a good example of how Prabhupada used it in this way. He normally talked about sanskaras as being those purificatory rituals. But in Bhaktivinoda Thakura in the Jiva Dharma mentions it. He says there are two types of sanskaras. He calls praktana of past lives and adhunika of the present life. And they've helped to frame your mental constitution, temperament, and contemplations. In other words, our current consciousness. Our consciousness is formed by these mental impressions from this lifetime and the past lifetime. And the point is that when the heart is cleansed by this process of the Sankirtan Jagya, of the chanting the holy name, then one is able to experience Krishna. And also relish the very process of hearing and chanting about Krishna. So there's this reciprocal relationship between chanting and purification. In one hand, the more that we hear and chant about Krishna, the more we become purified, and by the more we become purified, the more we relish the hearing and chanting of Krishna. So the two work together, they help us to advance in Krishna consciousness, get rid of all of the past anartas and samskaras, and bring us back to our original relationship of love with Krishna. So thank you very much. I'm sorry I ran a little bit over time. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So I don't want to keep people if you need to go, but if anyone has a question or two, we could take, or thoughts or comments.
That was a very nice class. I thought Bhaktivinoda Thakura Ihas Bhulin Sep Sukha Pe Mane. He says those impressions from previous life that forming the at present our consciousness, and the modes stimulate this, and the soul goes through this suffering. No one to be blamed for. But at the same time, he says, when someone engages in devotional service, there is a taste while the performing devotional service. That taste will actually remove all the pre-impression.
Yes.
There is no other way.
Yes. The taste of Krishna consciousness will remove those past impressions. Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, Prabhupada is really kind of saying a similar thing in his purport. He says we have all of these pictures or impressions in the heart. He says the real identity is covered, but therefore the cleansing process of Krishna consciousness removes all of those. And once again, we understand our real position. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.